Here's a surprising fact. Just 20% of all programmers write 80% of all usable code. Even more surprising than that, just 1% of programmers write 50% of all usable code. Even more surprising than that, this doesn't just apply to programming. Hey, it's Matthew, and this is the Matthew Kent Show. This concept that 80% of the results that you see are generated by just 20% of the causes is called the Pareto Principle. Sometimes it's called the 80-20 rule or the law of the vital few, and it applies all over the place. It's not always exactly 20% and exactly 80%, but it's often pretty close. So when you think about it, out of all the books that are sold every year, 20% of the authors make up 80% of the sales. And chances are you know the names of these people. J.K. Rowling, John Grisham, Daniel Steele writes all those romance novels. You have Dan Brown, wrote The Da Vinci Code and Angels and Demons and some other popular ones. You have Stephen King. You have all these people who, you know, write sort of these, there's like that Baldacci guy writes like a bunch of thrillers and like seems like he comes out with a book a year. So these are the people who sell 80% of all the books that get sold. And it's not a lot of people who make up this group. So the law of the vital few says we're going to see a few key causes that matter more than all the rest for explaining what we see going on in the world. A good example of this for personal finance would be investing and the stock market. So the S&P 500 is, roughly speaking, the 500 largest companies in America, and it makes up a little bit less than 20% of all available stocks out there, but it accounts for almost 80%, something like 75% of the value of the stock market. And so if you are investing in the S&P 500, you're investing in just 20% of all the stocks that are out there, as opposed to investing in like a total stock market index fund. But 80% of the whole value, they call that market capitalization, the total shares that are outstanding times the price, 80% of that value is captured by the S&P 500. So the point of talking about the Pareto Principle is that if you want big wins, you need to focus on the vital few instead of the trivial many. So what are the vital few of frugality? And so when you do a Pareto analysis, basically how you do it is you create a list, in this case of your spending by category, and you sort it by the largest to the smallest. And you should do this yourself. It's easy to do if you have a if you use like Mint or Personal Capital or one of these services, but you can do it on your own. You know, you can maybe download a copy of your spending. You know, if you use a debit card, you can download your bank statements, or if you use a credit card, you can download your credit card statements. You should run the numbers yourselves because your numbers might be different than these. But if we're talking about the average consumer, the way I did this is I pulled the most recent consumer expenditure survey, which the Bureau of Labor Statistics does. And so this is for the U.S., so, you know, international audiences, you're probably pretty similar, but this is in the U.S. This is how it breaks down. And so using their categories, they say that housing accounts for about 32.8% of the average household spending, so that's the largest single category. And then transportation accounts for 17%, food accounts for 13%, and you have other ones here. So those are the big three that we're going to talk about, but personal insurance is next, and it's the only other one above 10%, coming in at 11.4%. You have healthcare, then utilities, fuels, and public services, entertainment. And by the time you get to utilities, you know, you're down at like 6.4% of spending, entertainment 4.9%. They have other categories here, things like household furnishing, apparel and services, education, personal care products, things of that nature. They even have tobacco products and smoking supplies, which is 0.5% of the average person's spending. So if you don't smoke, great. Your expenses are marginally lower than somebody who does. Now, this doesn't exactly fit into Pareto, where you know they divide it up into 17 categories, and you know, in theory for Pareto, then the top three or four should represent the top 20%, which represent 80% of spending. Really, what we have here is the top three categories will only represent about 63% of spending. And the top four represent about 74% of spending. So a little bit less than what you'd expect for a Pareto. But still, I mean, the law of the 80-20 rule, it's a rule of thumb. It's a principle. And it's not an ironclad law. And so it does apply here. You know, obviously, housing is way more of an important decision than anything else. So since the biggest categories account for most of our spending, you know, for most people, the most important things to get right are going to be housing, transportation, and food. Now, I say most people, and it's important to remember everyone's different. And like I said, run the numbers yourself. You know, for me, it actually is different. So when you think about my situation, so I am the sole income earner for a family of five. Whew. And I made sure that I made a great deal. I got a great deal when I bought my house. And I mean a great deal. So our housing is dirt cheap, but feeding five people is, it's pretty expensive. So for us, food is by far our biggest expense. You know, for most people, it's third, it's a distant third to housing. For us, it's number one by a mile. In fact, to give you an idea of how much food is number one, I actually pay $225 extra payment on top of my mortgage every month in order to pay it off faster. And even if you count that $225 extra payment, which is really like a form of saving, I'm just saving in my house instead of, you know, saving in a savings account. Even if you include that as part of our fixed, you know, housing costs, we still spend more on food than we do on our housing. And again, it's actually not even that close. It's closer. It's still not that close. If I didn't pay that, oh my gosh, I think food would easily, it might double the next biggest expense, to be honest with you. So do the numbers yourself, because they could be different than the average person, than most people's minds certainly are. But in general, when you talk about the big wins and you talk about the Pareto approach, these are sort of some of the areas that it makes sense to focus on: housing, transportation, or food. Even if you're different than everybody else, chances are these three categories account for a disproportionate percent of your spending. So before we go on and break down those three categories in detail, let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. Now, it's important to remember here before we get into this that when we're talking about big wins, we're talking about hard work. So when you think about it, we talked about this with quick wins and in frugality. And if you go to moneythesimpleway.com, I have a nice little visual chart in this post. You can, if you're listening to this right after it came out, I wrote the post Big Wins the Simple Way just a couple days ago. I published it, so it should be towards the top of the blog. You can find it, and towards the bottom of that chart, you'll find of that post, you'll find this little chart. It's also in one of the main posts on the blog, which is Frugality the Simple Way. But basically, I break down, you know, hey, when you think about saving money, you can think about saving a lot of money or a little money. There's sort of a spectrum there. And you can think about your efforts being easy or hard. So there's those two variables, the amount saved and the difficulty. Are you saving a lot or little? Are you saving easy? Or is the difficulty easy or hard? And if you're saving a lot of money and it's easy, I would love to hear about that. I call that quadrant the unicorns. That's good luck finding those. You know, there's quick wins, which we talked about last time, where you can save not a lot of money. You can save a little, but it's pretty easy to do. Or you can front load the work and then kind of reap the benefits later, like I talk about with the Quick Wins Project. Then there are things where you only save a little and it's pretty hard. So I think for most people, clipping coupons falls into this. Although that could be easy if you've got like a method and a system and you know what you're doing. But certainly, like, converting double ply toilet paper into single ply toilet paper by hand is, it falls in here. Yeah, it'll save you money, but it's hard and it's gross and just stop it. But then the other category is the one that we're in now. It's the big wins. It has the potential to save you a lot. But listen, it's hard work. So, with a lot of the stuff that I'm going to start talking about today, it's going to seem like, well, I can't immediately do anything with this. It's not, instantly actionable because most people are not going to, listen to this podcast at, 8 a.m. and then at 9 a.m. go and, make the decision to move and find a new place and get all that taken care of. I mean, it's just not going to happen like that. So these are more things to sort of keep in the back of your mind. Maybe some of them are long-term goals to work towards. But because they are so important and because they do make up such a high percentage of your spending, they are worth thinking about and they are worth working through. So let's get started with housing. And again, this is the biggest expense, so this is the single biggest key to your ability to effortlessly stay within budget. Is to have housing that you can afford. And while the topic could get endlessly complicated if we let it, today we're just going to try to stick to a lot of the high-level principles, and maybe later on we're going to come back and hit some of these in depth and to go deeper to really unpack them completely. But now just some of the big principles. And obviously the first one is that you should shop around for your house or your apartment or wherever it is that you live. I mean, listen, if you shop around to get a good deal on a new computer, you should definitely be willing to shop around for much longer, by the way, to get your biggest purchase right. And if you're purchasing a house, chances are that's going to be the biggest purchase you ever make in your life. But either way, whether you're buying or renting, this is your biggest ongoing expense. And so, you need to get it right. So I remember my wife and I, when we got married, I spent several months before the wedding looking for the best deal on an apartment that I could find. And we ended up in a cute little two-bedroom unit that was dirt cheap compared to some of the more popular apartment complexes. I think it was like this little independently owned, there was like a building that just had like six apartment units in it, and didn't have a name or anything like that. It wasn't part of a big complex with tons of amenities or anything, but I mean it was perfect and the location was great and I loved it. And when we bought a house, it was a similar story where I mean this process, oh my gosh, I think it took 9 months from when we started looking to when we finally bought our house. But I got a killer deal, and so this house was a short sale, and so the people who were in here needed to move out and they were upside down their mortgage and the bank didn't want to. Anyways, a whole big long story behind it, but I got a killer deal. Now, I think, our real estate agent was, a little bit like wanting to, but overall she was understanding. But these people work on commission and they want to make the sale and get you to buy a house, and they'll be like, you should put an offer on this house, and I'm like, I don't want to put an offer on that house, and they're like, and you should come in at, more than the asking price to make sure you get it. And I'm like, I don't want to come in at more than the asking price. So you got to kind of stick to your guns. You got to do your homework ahead of time. You got to know what you're looking for. Deals are out there. It's frustrating. So I'll say this on a personal level and on an emotional level. As you're going through it, it feels like there's no deals out there. I'm wasting my time. I'm just feeling like an idiot because I'm looking for something in a certain range and it just doesn't exist. And every deal that I see is basically the same, and it's not that great. And then all of a sudden, the great deal comes along, and in hindsight, I'm like, oh yeah, spending 9 months looking for my house was totally worth it. At the time, I was like, am I just wasting my time? Am I an idiot? Like, what am I doing here? But so that's one strategy. Another strategy, which is maybe at least part of it, is more easily implementable, would be called house hacking. So I love alliteration. So house hacking. So we think about it this way: some people buy houses to live in, Some people are investors who buy houses to rent out. Why not do both with the same house? So the main idea with this, not the only way you can do it, but the main idea with this would be you find a multi-unit building and you buy that building instead of buying a house, and then you live in part of it and you rent out the other parts. But now you can use this kind of thinking even with like a single residence home. Like even if you own a home right now, your own home. So do you have a room you can rent out? Can you rent the whole house out temporarily while you're on vacation? You know, listen, especially if you're single, living with roommates is the cheapest way to go, just period. So when I, you know, before I got married, but when I was living with my buddies after college, it was about a 2-year period where that was happening. I made sure that I found a place that would let us put bunk beds in our apartment so that we could get more people inside of it. You know, some places will say, like, this is a 2-bedroom apartment. We can only have 2 people living there. And, you know, you're gonna split the lease 2 ways. Well, the lease gets a lot cheaper if you can split it 3 ways or 4 ways. If for a 2-bedroom apartment, it's hard to get much more than 4 people. Although, if you can and you're willing to do it, great, more power to you. But the more ways that you can split a lease, or the more ways you can split a mortgage, the cheaper it's going to get, basically. And so I know at least 3 friends that I can think of, and I'll just focus on one of them, who in college, they actually bought the place where they were living, and they did this house hacking thing where they used their roommates to help them pay off their mortgage. So I'm thinking of one of them, my friend David. He bought a condo, and it was actually a 4-bedroom, 4-bath condo. So 4 bedrooms, and each bedroom had its own private bathroom. And it looked just like a normal 2-bedroom apartment with a couple of extra doors in it. So in other words, if you walked in, you know, you saw the kitchen, and then next to the kitchen was kind of the living slash dining area. You know, you kind of had to put the dining table as close to the kitchen as possible so that you could have enough space for like a TV and some couches and stuff. But then instead of being like 2 little doors leading out to the bedrooms, there were 4 doors leading out to bedrooms. And he did the thing that I suggested with the bunk beds. He didn't do it in every room, but he had his own private room. And, you know, one of his friends had their own private room. And then in the other 2 bedrooms were split by 4 guys. So 2 guys in a room, you know, you put bunk beds in each room. They had to share a bathroom. And it was a little bit weird because I'd go over there and I'd hang out a lot. And so you had to, you know, you had to go through somebody's bedroom to get to a bathroom. There was no like shared bathroom for the whole place. But I mean, hey, he had 6 total people, 5 other people besides himself living there. And so chances are he was living for free. He was building equity. Now, obviously there's a risk here that you have to be aware of, and it's worth thinking about. But with some flexibility, you know, you can get around it. And the risk is if you do something like this in college, you're going to have to sell because chances are you're going to move away once you graduate. So maybe there's a chance that you could keep the unit and keep renting it out, and it's just more of a hassle because you're from a distance. Maybe you could use a property management company that'll look for tenants for you, although they probably are going to take a large chunk of your money away to do that. So there's different options, and of course you can sell, but if you have to sell, you're running the risk of, you know, the market tanking in the time that you own it, and you could be upside down on it. But again, you're mitigating that risk by paying aggressively towards the mortgage with the extra money that you're making from having a bunch of people living in this house that you own. So hopefully you've accumulated enough off of the people that are living there that you can weather any change in the price, you know. And so if the price goes down 10% and you have to sell it at a loss, it's like, well, hey, but the money that I made in rent more than makes up for that. And in that case, you know, sort of the worst case, it's just like, okay, well, you know, instead of you losing money on the deal, it's just like you didn't make as money as you thought you were going to. Whereas if the market goes up, you make more money than you thought than you were going to. You make the money that you built in equity, and you make the money that you get from the the price appreciating in value. And of course, the other thing about that is, 4 years, is not a ton of time to, one of the things about buying and selling houses all the time is that you're paying closing costs on both ends. And it's one of the reasons why people tell you, hey, you want to live there for at least 5 years is because, if you're living in a house 3 years and then moving like just all the time, you're incurring both buying and selling closing costs just all the time, and that's just it's not a very efficient way to think about your housing. But so that's house hacking, definitely something that you should consider. Another thing that's important, we'll talk about a couple more things with housing, is just getting a competitive loan. And if you didn't get a competitive loan the first time around, refinancing right now, interest rates are, I mean, rock bottom. So you should at least look into that, especially if you've got a loan, if you've got a mortgage, and your credit score right now is better than it was when you first got your mortgage, which it might be if you've been faithfully paying off your mortgage month after month. So, almost everybody who buys a house pays a ton in interest over the course of the loan. If you have a 30-year fixed rate mortgage, you pay less if you have a 15-year mortgage, but even then you still pay a lot. And the lower your interest rate is, just the less you're going to pay in interest total. So I mean, it depends on the exact terms of your loan. It depends on how much of a down payment you put down. It depends on the time period in which you're paying it off. It depends on whether or not you pay any extra. It depends on what the interest rate is. So there's a lot of factors at play here, but I mean, easily, the amount of interest that you pay could be half as much as the house that you buy. So let's just use that for an easy example. Let's just use the number $100,000. You bought a house for $100,000. You could easily end up paying more than $50,000 in interest as you pay off this house. Easily. If the given the right, or maybe I should say the wrong set of circumstances, you could end up paying, gosh, like $100,000 in interest, right? You could essentially double the purchase price of your home because you pay half of it in the actual price and you pay half of it in interest. So interest is it's a real cost that I mean, it's basically the cost that you pay for buying a house when you don't have enough money to buy a house. That's one way to think about debt in general. It's the price that you pay for buying something that you didn't save up the money to buy. And it's a big cost, and it's a hidden cost. It's a phantom cost because you're like, oh, this is my house payment. It's like, well, part of that house payment is paying for your house, and part of it is paying back the bank for your loan. So, that part doesn't do anything to build your net worth. And so along those lines, though, the sort of the last way to think about this, and this is not necessarily the most efficient. So if you want to be the kind of person who's like, I want to maximize the money that I have at age 65, this might not be the right way to go. But certainly if you like the thoughts of, security and minimizing risk, this is an attractive option, which is paying extra on your mortgage. And like I mentioned, this is what I'm doing. And one of the ways to save money on interest was what we just mentioned, which is getting a cheaper interest rate. But the other is paying your mortgage off early. So, the thing about paying off, especially if you do it, like the best time to pay extra on your mortgage is right now. Because right now you're paying a higher interest per month than you ever will again. Because that's the way a mortgage amortization works when you think about it. So the amount of principal plus interest that you're paying is fixed. So, and let's just use easy math numbers. If you're paying $500 a month, before taxes and insurance, so just the loan repayment portion of your housing payment of your mortgage is $500 a month. At the beginning, something like $400 of that a month is interest, and or maybe even more, and less than 100 is payment towards the principal. But anytime you pay money towards the principal, the interest that you owe next month is a little bit lower because the principal is a little bit lower, and the interest is just some percentage of the principal. So every single month that you make these payments, the interest portion of your payment goes down and the principal portion goes up. If you pay extra towards the principal, it lowers the interest that you're going to pay next month and the month after that and the month after that and the month after that and the month after that, and so on and so on. You get the idea. Now, it doesn't lower it by a lot, but again, every single extra payment lowers every single subsequent interest payment by a little. So that's how that adds up. And it does add up to a lot over time. You know, I've run the numbers on it because I run the numbers on everything. And I'm going to end up over just off of the extra principal that I've already paid owning my house for 5 years. And at first I was paying $100 extra a month. Now I'm paying $225 extra. I've slowly worked that up. Just off of the money that I'm paying extra, I'm going to end up over the course of the loan saving about 15 years or more off of the time frame of repaying my loan, and about $35,000. It's actually $30,000. I have a plan to ratchet that up to 35. So I mean, it makes a big difference. And again, that's for somebody like me who paid almost nothing for my house. You know, ironically, the more expensive your house was, the more power this strategy has in terms of raw absolute dollar amounts, you know, the saving potential. So paying extra is definitely it's a strategy that, you know, it's not for everybody. You might decide like, I've got this money, I could use to pay extra, but I'd get a higher return in the stock market. Great. I don't fault you at all for that. I think the stock market's great. Have fun with that. But if you're like, well, listen, I'd really just like to get this darn thing paid off because I don't like having this mortgage, and I don't like the fact that if I, you know, lose my job and, you know, I might lose my house or something like that, then yeah, definitely pay extra on your mortgage, reduce the total interest payments that you're going to make over your lifetime, and get that thing paid off earlier. I think it's a great option. All right. So when it comes to our second major arena, our second major category, which is transportation, the most impactful thing is a little bit drastic, and so you might not want to do it, but you might, and that's ditching your car. Cars are a very expensive way to get around. So for a lot of people, this won't work, but I want to talk to at least two kinds of people. If you're one of these kind of people, you should at least think about getting rid of your car. So if you live in a big city with good public transportation, of course, you probably already know this, but you can probably get around just fine without a car. And it might be more convenient. So there might be some of you listening who do live in a big city, and you know that, like, yeah, I could get around without a car, but it's inconvenient. But listen, cars are really expensive. So is a little bit of convenience a good justification for spending the kind of money that you're spending for your second biggest expense? You know, I mean, is there another place in your life where you can add convenience for cheaper? Is, I guess, what I'm asking you here. But the other kind of person that can benefit for ditching their car is, you know, the two-car family can become a one-car family. And that's where we're at right now. And, you know, I don't like to talk about the pandemic a ton, but, you know, and we'll see what happens here, because the way it's looking, I'm recording this episode in May 2021, is maybe they're going to want us to come back to work. I have no idea. I've been working from home since, you know, March 2020. And, you know, it's becoming like, why do we have this second car now? We needed the second car when I drove 20 minutes to work every day. And now it's like, you know, we haven't needed it for the past year, but I'm kind of just holding on to it, basically just to see, like, are they going to make me start coming back into the office? And if they are, it's like, well, it's a good thing that, you know, I still have the car. But if they're not, then it's like, man, I need to just get rid of this thing and get rid of the mortgage payments and get rid of, you know, because even if it becomes really inconvenient and, you know, I need, you know, to ask friends for a ride, or even if I do need to just get an Uber, I mean, getting an Uber every now and then is cheaper than insurance. You know, I mean, you could easily be paying, you know, $50 a month in insurance, $100 a month in insurance. You know, if just once every couple of months you need, you know, one ride somewhere and you use an Uber for that, I mean, you're saving money just on insurance alone, and that's not even counting, you know, gas and the actual cost of the depreciation of the car and all these kind of things. So if you can ditch your car. I'm thinking about it now, and it's a shame because I like my car. I've got my car's a 2003 Toyota Corolla, but that's not the important part. Everybody thinks the make and model. The important part is it's a stick shift. And I don't even know if they make stick shifts anymore, which is such a shame. I don't know what it is. You know, you feel it's fun to do things that you know not a lot of other people can do. And I'm not trying to, you know, I know how that can sound and boastful or arrogant, but I mean, in all honesty, like, just like as a piece of advice to give you, you know, like, man, it's kind of fun. So I love driving that thing around. You know, you when you have a manual transmission, over time you get to know it and you can get really smooth with it. And yeah, it's just fun. I don't know, but so that would be a shame. But at the same time, it's like I don't drive it, so you know, if I'm not going back into the office, gotta get rid of that thing. And I'll save on insurance. I'll save on, you know, maintenance and repairs. I'll make a little bit of money off of the sale. Not a ton because it's a really old car, right? It's 2021 now. This is a 2003 model, which means that I think it came out in 2002. But, you know, at the same time, you know, any car that runs, you're going to get at least a little bit of money for. And so, you know, I'd make money off the sale. I'd save money in a bunch of other places. And that's definitely the way that I think my family is going to go. But the other thing, and so I mentioned my car is a 2003. That leads me to the other big way to save money. You know, even more than like, do you want to buy new or used or whatever the debates people have are. But the second way to save money on cars is to drive your car into the ground. And I mean, you don't actually have to literally drive it until the wheels fall off, but just don't, you know, don't go and buy a new car every 3 to 5 years. The longer you own your car, the less it costs over time. And it's a big expense. So, you know, my car, I've had it for, years now. And I've never thought about buying a new car. So the big objection to this is always, maintenance and repairs become, you know, you might be paying more in maintenance and repairs than the cost of buying a new car. Not really. That math just doesn't work or even come close to working. And, you know, not to run the numbers here because it's hard to run the numbers, quote unquote, on a podcast where you're not looking at them. But just as a simple thought experiment, let's think about, let's imagine you have a really bad year in terms of car repairs, like a really bad year. You need $2,000 of car repairs. So that's a really bad year in terms of car repairs. And probably in that year, you're going to be thinking like, man, should I have just bought a new car? No. So, I mean, like, what would your car payment have been? $225 a month? You know, $180 a month? $180 a month, I think, is roughly $2,000 a year. $225 a month would have been way more than $2,000 a year. So even in your worst car repair year ever, you're paying basically as much or less as somebody would be paying in just their monthly car payment if they kept buying a new car every single year and never paid it off because they just keep buying and buying and buying and they always have a car payment. And that's in a really bad year. You know, in a good year, you'll pay far less in a year than most people pay in a month for their car payment, you know, and a lot of that will be like oil changes. You get like 3 or 4 oil changes a year. And, you know, even if you're taking it to the dealership instead of using it yourself, and even if you're using the expensive synthetic, you know, high mileage oil, I mean, you know, what are you going to be paying? Like, you know, like $200 a year for oil changes? I mean, listen, yes, it's annoying when your car breaks down if you have an older car. For sure, and maintenance, and in those moments, I mean, you're like, oh, am I making the right decision? Would life just be so much easier if I had a new car? But, you know, if you're needing to save money, the choice is pretty clear. Drive it as long as you can. Take good care of it. Drive it as long as you can, and you'll get the most value out of it. Another reason for this, too, is, you know, if you're buying new or close to new, you know, so you have this idea of the depreciation curve, which is just, you know, over time, how much value, resale value does your car have? And it has the most resale value right when you buy it. And then it starts dropping. And the newer it is, the faster it drops. And then the whole curve kind of turns and it slowly starts to level off. So, you know, basically each year that you drive it after the depreciation curve starts to tail off, the resale value is not going down that much each year. At the beginning, it's going down a lot each year. So, you know, basically, that's one way of making it cheaper, is that you're getting extra years of driving where you're not running down the value of your vehicle. If you're, you know, stuck buying a new vehicle once every 3 to 5 years, then basically, like, every year that you're driving your car is losing thousands of dollars of value every single year. Whereas, you know, if you just take one car and you drive it for, let's say, 20 years, you know, then basically, like, between years, let's say 17 and 18, the car doesn't lose any value whatsoever. So that's one way of thinking about it. Just like with buying a house, you know, shopping around is a good idea. It's a big purchase. It's worth taking the time to get a good deal. So there's a book called I Will Teach You to Be Rich, which is a good book with a scammy title, and it's got Ramit Sethi, and he uses all the time examples of negotiating for basically everything, which I love. You know, you negotiate your salary, negotiate your fixed expenses and your credit card fees, like that, things like that. And of course, negotiate for a car. And he says, like, you know, you should negotiate like an Indian. And when he says that, what he means is he's talking about stories from his childhood where over the course of multiple days, he would go with his dad to the dealership to negotiate. And he says he even remembers, I think, having breakfast at a dealership one time. But anyways, when Ramit bought his car, he waited to the end of the year when the salesmen were, you know, desperate to make quotas and get squeezing some last, you know, commissions and hit bonuses and things like that. And he started emailing several dealerships that, you know, all had the same make and model in stock. So he'd done the research online, and he let them know, like, hey, I'm going to be buying a car, you know, before the end of the year. So it was like mid-December. He's like, within 2 weeks, I'm going to be buying a car from somebody. And just give me your best offer. And then as the best offers start coming in, he started basically like a bidding war. Like, he'd say, hey, over here, they're offering me this. You're only offering me that. And, you know, basically he got a great deal on his car. So this, a strategy like this, is it's a great strategy. It's a great book. You know, I recommend it. I Will Teach You to Be Rich. If you go to moneythesimpleway.com, it's also one of my recent posts is a book review. And, you know, I share some of his tips for like salary negotiation and stuff like that. So definitely worth a read. But yeah, I mean, again, you know, hey, if you're going to shop around for, you know, a computer, which is maybe like, you know, a several hundred to $1,000 purchase, you know, I mean, a car is a several thousand to tens of thousands of dollar purchase. So you should spend more time shopping around for a car than you do, you know, for let's say like a computer or something like that. You know, another one for transportation, and like I just mentioned with Ramit and negotiating. So that was more for shopping around. But also, you know, you can negotiate with these things, whether you're buying it from a private seller or from a dealership or wherever. And I mean, listen, if you don't at least try to negotiate, you'll definitely pay full price. You know, negotiating is annoying. I don't like negotiating. I feel awkward. And, you know, I mean, and I've negotiated at dealerships before, and they have all these annoying tactics. Like, they'll, you know, they'll say, hold on, I've got to go ask my manager, and they'll walk away and make you sweat it out. And who knows if they're actually asking the manager. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. But you just have to sit there and feel bad about yourself and twiddle your thumbs while they go get some coffee or ask their manager or whatever it is they do. But, I mean, you have to remember, if you're at a dealership, they want to sell you a car. They want really, 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 really badly to sell you a car. So, I mean, if you want to negotiate, you definitely can get at least a discount. Whether or not you get the best deal in the world depends on how well you negotiate and how savvy and smart you are about it and all that. But the chances of you not getting them to budge on the price at all are basically negligible. So just, you know, keep that in mind as you go in there. And then the last one is, you know, buying late model used vehicles. So we sort of covered this already with the idea of the depreciation curve. But, you know, I mean, just again, the idea is that a car's value depreciates rapidly at first, but then the resale value sort of stabilizes over time. It's still going down. It's just a long, steady decline. So if you're buying a 1 year or 2 year old car, its value is sinking like a rock every year. But
If you buy a car that's, I don't know, like 2 or 3 years old, then the value's already sunk like a rock, and now the depreciation is starting to tail off. And I mean, like a 2-year-old car is very close to being as good as new, but it's usually priced as if it were much cheaper. So you can take advantage of that. And so, I mean, these are a few of the ways that you can think about reducing your transportation budget. All right, and our last category is food. Now, food is a little bit tougher to talk about or different than the other ones because food involves ongoing decisions. In other words, choosing where you want to live, we talked about basically a bunch of decisions that you're making up front, and then you can sort of forget about it for months or even years as you live in the same place. Same thing with, buying a car. You're making a lot of decisions about the actual buying of the car, but then once the car is bought, you just kind of drive the car around, and you're not making it a ton of decisions over and over again. But with food, you're making choices about how you spend money on food, every week, or in some cases every day as you eat out. And so it's good to think about how you can create sort of systems or routines or habits around eating. So that you can follow them and sort of save money without thinking too much about it. And I think the easiest one is eat out less. You should think about eating out less and cooking more. Now, I don't have time to break down all of the math behind it, but I really do recommend on my blog, moneythesimpleway.com. If you search for it, there's a post. And I've only got like 30 or 40 something like that posts right now. So, you can sort of scroll through the you can go from page one to page two. I don't know if it's on page two or page three, but there's a post called The Math Behind Why Cooking is So Much Cheaper Than Eating Out. And I break down the numbers two ways because it's actually a little bit difficult to determine the cost of cooking. And so you can either go with the bottom-up approach, which I call it, which is, working from the ingredient prices and then trying to figure out the cost of meals, or you can do what I call the top-down approach, which is you can, look at your grocery spending over a long period of time, like let's say a year, and then divide that by the number of meals that you would have eaten during that period. And so the way I do that is I estimate, I use my credit card statements to estimate the number of times that I ate out because the credit cards will categorize like, hey, here are your restaurant purchases. So like, okay, those are meals that I ate away from the home. So here's how many meals there are in a year minus here's how many times we ate out. And so here's how many time meals that we would have eaten in the home. So divide your grocery bill by that. So I break the math down two ways. But no matter how you break the math down, it becomes pretty clear. $3 is sort of the cutoff point. Now, I'm recording this in May of 2021. If if we get hit by like crazy inflation, those numbers might end up being sort of ridiculous. And inflation is something, even without crazy inflation, in my lifetime, I've seen affect the price of food. But the way it stands right now is, as I see it, $3 is the rock bottom price that you could get for eating out. And you're like, how would you eat out for $3? And it's like you'd go to McDonald's and you do the dollar menu and you get exactly three items off the dollar menu, right? So two cheeseburgers, a fries, and a water. And plus tax, you're going to end up paying like $3.18 or something like that. Now, not a great meal, not very healthy, not very satisfying, but that's about as cheap as you can get if you're eating out. And it could be way more expensive, right? Everybody here has spent $5 per meal eating out. You've spent $8 per meal eating out. You've spent $10 per meal eating out. You go to a restaurant, you've maybe spent more than $10 per meal eating out. Maybe there've been times you spent $25 for a meal, or more, again. Whereas when it comes to cooking, maybe some meals are above that $3 tier, but in general, it's really, really easy to get your meals to average out to less than $3 without being like even crazy frugal, with just being sort of like just normal. The normal math of cooking, I think, lends itself to meals that are close to $3 per meal or less. And again, some are much less. And the most frugal people out there are actually able to drive their food costs down to $1 per person per meal, which is crazy and awesome, and I love it. But anyways, definitely check out that post, The Math Behind Why Cooking is So Much Cheaper Than Eating Out. I break down the numbers in full. But the other thing that you can do is just to prioritize, inexpensive staples. So again, while you're eating at home, Just find a few meals that are relatively inexpensive. So when you think about it, like rice is dirt cheap. So are beans. That sounds like an awful lot like a meal. Plus, neither one of these ingredients is likely to spoil, and that's one of the costs of eating at home, is that some of the food that you buy is you're not going to eat. It's going to spoil. It's going to go bad. But having, go to like having meals that you can use these cheap ingredients for is a great way to make your dollar go further in terms of your food spending. And you don't have to go that cheap as like rice and beans. That's just, the go-to example that I have in my head of like, here's a cheap meal, rice and beans. And I mean, they're an outrageously inexpensive source of calories. You can think about other cheap staples, like eggs are a very cost-effective source of protein. And so like that's something that we'll do sometimes. And I love meat. Like, man, I'm not by any means a vegetarian. I am a carnivore. I want to eat more meat, but sometimes to save money, I will do something like, okay, we're going to make some fried rice. My wife likes it when I make fried rice. And, instead of doing chicken fried rice, you make eggs the protein because eggs are cheaper than chicken, which is ironic when you think about it, but don't think about it too much. Anyways, so, prioritize inexpensive staples. You can also, I think a good strategy is to master, 5 to 10 frugal favorites. Again, I like alliteration, but so you have these go-to meals, these frugal favorites that prioritize the inexpensive ingredients. And the advantage here is that you become really efficient at shopping for the ingredients, and you become really efficient at preparing the meal. So my wife, we actually had it just last night. She makes a dish usually around once a week, just because it's so convenient to put into the routine. The main ingredients are penne noodles, broccoli, and kielbasa sausage. There's also salt, pepper, butter, garlic, that kind of stuff. But my wife has told me that she's cooked this meal so much that she could literally just make it in her sleep. And not literally, I guess. She could make it in her sleep, as the expression goes. Anyways, it's nice when you get to that point where you're just like, it's not even, because that's one of the things people complain about with cooking is like, oh man, it's work. It's like, well, it's not work if you get really good at it, or if you get really practiced at it, so that you have, these sort of ones that you can do on autopilot. And we have fun sometimes, cooking new things or making something different, and it's a little bit of a challenge, and it gives you something to do in the kitchen. But sometimes it's nice just to like, it's almost even easier than getting everybody in the van and going out somewhere. It's just, hey, here's this thing that I've cooked hundreds of times, and just make it one more time without even thinking about it. It's almost like your commute at work, where it's like you can do it, but you don't even remember doing it because you've done it so often that your brain can almost just check out as you're doing it. It doesn't even feel like work or anything like that. So I think those are, and again, with all these things, remember, this stuff is hard work, harder work than the quick wins. The quick wins, it's like a quick little project, and over the course of a couple of days, you can do some work and lock in some savings. Big wins with housing and transportation, you can lock in savings for a long time, but it's even more work than the quick wins project was. With food, it requires something of an ongoing, investment of time and thought and energy, which is not ideal. But again, for me, it's my biggest expense by far. So we haven't covered all the hacks here, but we've covered certainly a few of them, and the high level of how to think about saving money on some of these things. And playing defense here and keeping these costs under control, it really is a key to making sure that you can build a margin of safety into your personal finance situation, which is hugely important. It's key to making sure that you can spend, far less than you earn, giving you opportunity to, invest, and to build wealth and all these kind of things. And so, in future episodes, we're continuing this series here this year, and we're going to move on to talking about strategies for earning more money, because it's just one part of personal finance is the spending less. We also got to talk about the earning more. And then we got to talk about what you do with this surplus. So we're going to talk about how to invest, the basics of investing, the introduction to the stock market, all these kind of things. So if you're not subscribed, make sure to subscribe and get all these episodes as they come out. If you like what you're hearing, You know, I really appreciate it if you tell somebody who loves podcasts about this show. And really, that's my best chance of growing is through word of mouth, and especially through you telling people who already listen to the podcast. Because it's one thing to convert somebody to listening to podcasts in general and my podcast in particular. It's another thing to tell somebody who already listens to podcasts, like, hey, I've got a good one you should listen to. But that basically wraps us up for this time. Thank you so much for listening, and especially thank you so much for tolerating my voice. I don't know if you can hear it, but my voice is a little hoarse. By the way, the story behind that, and I know I said I was about to end the episode, but like, I went to Disney the other day. They've lifted a lot of their mask restrictions, but you still have to wear them when inside. And so I was in line, and it's hard to talk to people through the mask because, well, for obvious reasons. So anyways, my voice is a little hoarse, and I've been drinking water in between recording segments of this episode, but I can tell it's getting tired. So it's time for me to sign off. Thank you so much for listening. I'll talk to you next week.